Good evening. Good evening, El Yisrael, America, Great Britain, and if anybody's else somewhere on the globe, good evening to you. Last week, we finished Klal Hay. I think what I did was I spoke about at the very end of last week's year. By the way, Derech Agav, the shiur is dedicated to Ilui Nishmas Rachel Leah Bas Reb Chaim Tzvi. And I want to now perhaps take the Asar Klal in general and put it in an important perspective. And the reason we're doing this is because we're now going to encounter, beginning with Klal Vav, a certain amount of... So for example, the Goyin has devoted Klal Hay to the Vav Ketzavos, meaning the lower six spheres, Chesed, Gvur, Teferes, Netzach, Hoy, Yisoyed, usually referred to as Chagat Nahi, and then he spoke about Malchus, the sphere of Malchus, and he spoke about Kesavaluch. And last week we devoted the entire Tashir to showing how, in fact, actually Malchus, in a certain sense, completes a cycle and a recursion by which the acts of man, which man implement as a virtue of his free will, become, in a certain sense, the initial thought and will of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So as we go down through the ten spheres and we find out which Malchus, this somehow makes a loop and Malchus converts itself back to Keser. It's almost as if the tenth spheres, at least from this point of view, constitute the surface of a circle, the surface of a sphere or a circle, perhaps a torus. And in fact, we begin with Chachma Bina Vadas, and then the lower six spheres. Then we get to Malchus, and Malchus somehow generates in a retroactive manner the initial will of Kodesh Baruch Hu, which is Keser. So actually, we take this Taurus, it turns out that Malchus is from the man side, Keser is from the God side. So therefore, we actually twist it and make it into what's called a Moiba strip in topology. So therefore, basically, when we get to Keser, Keser is from the man side, Malchus is from the man side. Malchus, which are the acts of man, represent retroactively the will of God from the God side. So man is going towards God. Keser is God going towards man. And therefore the Taurus of the ten spheres is twisted between Malchus and Keser. Those of you who have some type of topological imagination will be enjoying this. Those of you who don't, will just have to listen and believe that this is true. And so therefore the map of the sphere, the geometrical model of the spheres, represents what topologists call a Moiba strip, in which the orientation of the manifold changes when you get to Malchus, from Malchus and it goes to Keser, but nonetheless there's a recursive geometry and structure to the structure of the spheres. However, what I want to speak about tonight is on actually a deeper level. Because speaking about recursion, the Goyin, beginning in Klal Vav, which is on Daf Kuf Lamed Vav in your text, and which begins on line 188, starts speaking about Atik Yoimin again. Atik. We remember that the Goyin actually spoke about Atik in Klal Aleph, and he spoke about the fact that the first symptom, and now referring to in Daf Kuf Chav Vav, which was at the end of Klal Aleph. And the Goyin said, Zehat Tzimtzum HaRishon Nikra B'Shem Atik. This first Tzimtzum is called Atik. And the Goyin mentioned it's called Atik for two reasons. One reason is because it's the first Tzimtzum, it's the first of several Tzimtzumim. And the second reason is because of Lashon Siluk, a disengagement, Vayatek, from the word in Lashon HaKodesh, Vayatek, which means to move from one place to another. Here, in fact, the Goyin is actually going to invoke Atik again. Because the Goyin says, Vazayin Elo, are now in line 188, and these seven spheres, which means the six spheres, the Vav Ketzavot, Chesed, Gevurah, Tef'eres, Netzach, Hod Yesod, that those are six, and then together with Malchus, those are seven, the seven lower spheres. Hazayin Elul, these seven lower spheres, says the Goyim, Shimshu, they took an active part, they were engaged, B'Zayin Yemei Breishis, during the 7 days of creation, Vein Zayin Tachtoines, and they were the lower, seven lower parts of Atik Yoimin. Now here the Goyim refers to Atik, but first of all he calls it Atik Yoimin. Number one, Atik Yoimin is actually the Lashon of the Zohar, and he speaks about the Zayin Tachtoines of Atik Yoimin, which means that since there are seven lower spheres of Atik Yoimin, you have three higher spheres of Atik Yoimin, which the Goyim is also going to speak about. So therefore, Atik Yoimin represents a whole, in and of itself, a whole, that was W-H-O-L-E, a entity in and of itself, which has actually 10 spheres. Now, the fact is, so this Lashon, the language of the Goyim, Atik Yoimin, is much different than the Lashon of Atik, right? Because in fact, actually, Atik Yoimin itself contained itself 10 spheres. In addition to this, beginning in Klal Tes, this is coming attractions, but on line 260, which is on Daf Kuf Mem, the Goyim actually speaks about that this Atik has actually has what's called three heads, Tlatz Reishin, three heads, and these three heads, the Goyim says, are actually Gulgolta, which in Aramaic, in Zohar Aramaic, refers to the skull. Avira refers to, I guess, the cranial cavity. And Moichas Timah refers to the brain. So in fact, actually, we have the three parts of Atik Yoimin. The important point to notice is that Atik Yoimin now takes upon a human image, because in fact, actually, if Atik has three ration, and three ration are three parts of the head, which is the skull, the brain, and the cranial, I guess the cranial fluid between the brain and the skull. So all of a sudden, we see that Atik Yoimin, in fact, takes on what's called anthropomorphic or human features. In fact, actually, the Goyim will go on in Klal Tes, and he'll also speak about other spheres which the spheres of Chochmah and Bina will be characterized as Abba and Ima. Those are, in fact, in the later Klolim. And then he's going to speak about Adam Kadmai. What am I getting at? What I'm getting at is the following thing. We see over here that after Klal Hei, beginning from Klal Vav onwards, there's a subtle change in the language, in the terminology of the Goyim, that previously, with the exception of the verb Atik, which referred to Tzemtzum, the Kabbalah of the Goyim was limited to what's called Sfiras, Chochmah Bina V'Das. Then, as we get to the Zayin Tachtoine, which in fact actually is also language of spheres, then in beginning in Klal Vav and Zayin, Ches and Tes and Yod, the Goyim launches into a different terminology, a language of what's called Paltzufin, right? A Paltzuf literally means a human face. So we see that there's a interesting division in the Klolim of the Goyim, that up to and including Klal Hei, the Lashon, the language of the Goyim, is a language of Sfiras. Beginning in Klal Vav, Zion, especially Ches, Tes, and Yod, the Lashon of the Goyim is a Lashon of Paltzufin. We're going to explain in a little while the difference between a Sfira and a Paltzuf. This is actually very, very much rests upon the Lashonis of the Zoya, but the conceptual understanding is in fact rooted, of course, in the Kabbalah of the Ari. Now, that's one point. One important point that has to be mentioned. But there's a second important point, which also has to be mentioned. There seems to be also a recursion in the Goyim. Because, beginning in Klal Vav, the Goyim, again, starts to speak about the process of his pashtus and his talkus. We will recall that in the previous klolim, the Goyim spoke about the creation of the world, that at one time the world was at one with the Chachma of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then there was a disengagement. The Goyim called that the Shvira, but what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in fact, actually left was called the Rishima, an impression upon the physical world, and that was actually a process which called his Pashtus and his Talkus. His Pashtus means a spreading out, an illumination, to use a term, right, and that is used in Yari. And then, in fact, there's a histalkus, a drawing within. His pashtus and histalkus, the process of pashtus histalkus, which we spoke about to a certain extent, how the Goyim understood that this was actually the process by which HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in fact, gives structure to the physical world. However, this is pashtus and histalkus of the Goyim, right, was basically kept in a bare minimum. We saw in the previous klolim was that this pashtus and histalkus just basically created a reshima. It created a reshima in the physical creation. It created a reshima in the Torah. And by man intellectually apprehending the reshima, both in the physical and in the Torah, man through his intellect would be able to recover the chachma of the Bria, the chachma of creation, and the chachma of the Torah, which was in close affinity with the Kadosh Baruch Hu at the time of creation. So in other words, the Shema represents the structure, both in physical creation and both in Torah, which man through his intellect apprehends and is able through that in order to arrive at that wisdom which was at the very basis of the creation both of the world and of the Torah that was given in Har Sinai. Now, in Klal Vav and Klal Zayin, the Goyim also speaks about Ishpashtus and Histalkus, but the Goyim is actually going to introduce several added terms that we haven't seen so far in the Klalim. First of all, the Goyim is going to speak about Kalim, the formation of Kalim. That's very, very important. It's very significant. In the Ari, in the Shara Kodin, the whole purpose of this Pashtus Talkus is to create the Kalim of Atzilus. The purpose of this Pashtus Talkus, as we saw in the Goyim, was basically just had the effect of creating a Rishimai. But here, in fact, actually, the Goyim is going to specifically speak about Kalim. But even more so, we're going to see, actually, that the Kli is also going to have two aspects to it. The Kli is going to have an aspect of what's called Pinimius and Chitzonius. In fact, the light is going to have an aspect of what's called Makif and Pinimi. And the Kli is going to have an aspect of Chitzoni and Pinimi. Now, the aspect of the Chitzoni and Pinimi, as we'll see in Mitzvah Hashem, in Klal Vav, introduces a dimension of physicality. The Chitzonius of the Kli, as we'll see, is actually physicality. For the first time, we're going to see that the Goyim is dealing with the issue of physicality. It is true that the Rishimai, which the Goyim spoke about in the previous klolim, was a Rishimai on the physical world. But once again, that Rishimai referred to the scientific structure which can be intellectually apprehended in the physical world. For all intents and purposes, it can be referring to the mathematical structure and scientific structure of natural law, which contained in the physical world, but didn't confront necessarily the actual phenomena of physicality. But we're going to see that in Klal Vav, the Goyim actually deals with the notion of physicality. Chitzonius HaKli is going to speak about about the Yetzer Hara. He's going to speak about the physical world, qua physical world, not something which is intellectually apprehended and scientifically studied, but the world as it's physically felt in the world. In addition, in Klal Zayin, the Goyim is also going to introduce a new type of hashgacha. Up till now, in the previous klolim, hashgacha was basically a proximity to God. In other words, during the 6 days of creation, the proximity of the creation with God, the oneness The unity of the creation with God refers to a high level of hashkacha. The disengagement of the physical world from God represents a low level of hashkacha. But the fact is that in Klal Zayin, the Goyim is going to introduce very interesting something called hashkacha klalis and hashkacha pratis. Hashkacha klalis refers to hashkacha in a general sense. That refers to the lights, the infinite Ein Sof, when it's described by the Ari as being in the state of what's called the gulin. And then he's going to speak about what's called Yosha, which refers to Hashkacha Pratis, which means that the Goyim is going to introduce the notion of the general and the particular, the general class and the particular class. Now, these are concepts which complicate the picture in a far greater magnitude than we encountered in the earlier Klolim. So, but it's basically the same content. The same concept, meaning as Pashas Talkos, but already the God is introducing physicality. The God is introducing particularness, the specific members of a general class. The general class could be understood to be the mathematical structure, the scientific structure of something, the logical structure of something, the Rishima. But the particularity of the creation is introduced, as well as its physicality, in Klolim Vav and Zayin. The question which I really want to focus on is, why is the Goyim now giving us Shi'urim of Chazorah? Why is the Goyim repeating himself and going back to the same things which we saw, but not only in greater detail, but adding the dimensions of physicality and particularity? In other words, physicality and particularity are being added to create a more complicated structure of his pashtus and his talkus, much more complicated and much more physical and particular in the klolim which begin after klal hey, vav zayin ches tes and yod, and as opposed to the structure of his pashtus and his talkus, which we encountered in the first klolim, aleph beis gimel and dalet. Now, what I want to do is I want to put these, so we mentioned here very, very two important observations. Number one is the Goyim, observation number one, the Goyim makes after Klal Hei a very important shift from the Lashonis of Sfiris to the Lashonis of Partzufim. That's shift number one. Shift number two, the Goyim makes an important shift from the Lashonis of his pashtus and his talkos with respect to a reshima. The reshima is the only structure which exists in the earlier klolim, which is apprehended by man. The Goyim makes a very, very, makes central man's intellectual apprehension, chachma bina v'das. But after klal hei, vav zayin, these pashtus and talkos result in kalim, and the kalim actually serve to differentiate between what's called chitzon and pnimi. Chitzay meaning very physical, that's physicality, real physicality, not an ishima which is intellectually apprehended, but real physicality, yetzahara, musar, all the things that they speak about, the mashkichim speak about. And in addition, in Klal Zayin, the lashonis are what's called igulim and yosher, hashkacha klolis, hashkacha platis, general versus particular. So this second shift is a shift in the physical particular direction. What is the relationship between these two vital shifts in the Goyim? In order to understand this, we have to go back, and I want to go back, really, to Klal Aleph. And we spoke about in Klal Aleph, we spoke about the fundamental revolution which was initiated, which was established by the Ari. And that was the revolution, and the theological revolution, and understanding the nature of God, and in particular, God's relationship to the world and to man. I mentioned that the Ari established what's called an irreducible dichotomy in the nature of God. There's God in and of himself, and God as he relates to the world, as he relates to man. God as he reveals himself to man. This irreducible dichotomy is something which is not known to the medieval Jewish philosophers, in particular the Rambam, but the Ari introduces it very, very at the very outset of the Eitz Chaim, in this first Chakira, is what is the purpose of creation? And this reducible dichotomy then allows man to have much more of a direct relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kodesh Baruch Hu cannot be described without encroaching upon an anthropomorphism of the actual essence of God, which of course reduces to paganism. I mentioned too that this revolution of the Ari, which the Goyin understands to be the fundamental axiom of all Kabbalah, he says this is something, the distinction made by all the Mekubalim, the reference clearly of the Goyin to the Ari, and the Goyin's insinuation is that if you don't accept this rule, the dichotomy, you cannot be a Mekubal. You're either an Ovid of an Azara, or you missed the revolution of the Ari. But I mentioned that the Goyin's revolution, which he ushered in at the end of the 16th century, was given philosophical expression in the 17th century. I spoke about what's usually called the onset of Western philosophy, namely the philosopher Descartes. In his Cogito Ergo Sum, Descartes establishes a dichotomy between mind and body by a series thoughts of skepticism. Descartes establishes that the only thing that a person can know with certainty is his own mind. And after that, he tries to build out and try to establish a rational understanding of the world around him. I mentioned that this ontological or epistemological way for Descartes, this mind-body dichotomy, was not only a revolution in philosophy. The Greeks simply did not even have the way of even talking about a mind-body problem. It established a dichotomy between man's mind and the world, and Greek philosophy, especially the Rambam, which I spoke about in the first section of the Book, in chapter 68 and 69, the intellect, when it's active, then the subject, the object of the subject, the knower, the object of knowledge, and the act of knowledge become one in the same. Descartes basically placed a wedge in between the knower and the object of knowledge. But in addition to the epistemological and ontological revolution that was made by Descartes, there was also a theological revolution, because we see that in Descartes' works, we have a seemingly analogous contradiction the way Descartes speaks about God. On one hand, Descartes identifies God with clear ideas about the world, the mathematical structures which man has, which man can be sure of. On the other hand, Descartes speaks about a God who's an infinite. So, an excellent article about this, I refer to the Cambridge readings of Descartes, in which an excellent article is written about this. I think I mentioned this. But the fact is that I feel that in Descartes, and we spoke about the fact that and the ideas of many philosophers of intellectual historians, Descartes, as well as other philosophers of his time, 17th century, namely Malebranche, certainly Spinoza, even Newton, right, immanenticized God. God now became something who was imminent in the world, and namely because the world was now being discovered to have a certain mathematical structure, something which the Greeks attributed only to the celestial world. Therefore, the Greek and medieval God, so to speak, was transcendental. With the increasing mathematization of the physical world, already, you know, clear, lucid, and abstract ideas become embedded within physical reality, and as a result of that, God now becomes more imminent. Then, in fact, actually, this dichotomy between mind and body, in terms of Descartes' ontological, epistemological philosophy, in fact, actually become expressed in theology as a dichotomy between God in and of himself and God as relates to the world. Now, of course, Descartes did not have what we would in the Hamishian world call the sprach to actually establish the dichotomy, but the fact is that we see basic contradictions in Descartes' writings, which in fact actually point to this type of dichotomy in this thinking about God. In other words, ontology and theology are two sides of the same coin, right? The dichotomy between man's mind and the external world becomes translated for the believer in a dichotomy between God and of himself, and God as he relates to the world, or God as the source of man's understanding of the world, which is more or less the same thing. Now, this, in fact, was the important chiddush, the historical novella of the Arizal, and the Arizal, of course, predates Descartes by certainly about 20, 30 years, and this dichotomy, as I said, mentioned before, is understood by philosophers, by historians of intellectual history as being the onset of modern thinking, also too, in a certain sense, is also a revolution which the Ari inaugurates within the revelation of the Kabbalah at the end of the 16th century. The fact is that world history goes on, world philosophy goes on. The dichotomy between mind and body actually reaches a high point, actually a low point in the history of thinking with philosophy of David Hume. He wanted a good Scottish philosopher. And David Hume basically cast doubt and skepticism on our ability to actually draw any conclusions about eternal law in the physical world. By definition, the physical world is ephemeral. One cannot witness an infinite number of trials within the physical world. Hume said that what we ascribe to the physical world, laws, natural laws, we ascribe to the physical world, like gravity and all different types of laws of physics, are not inherent in the physical world whatsoever. And because of this, Hume cast tremendous skepticism on our ability to make any statements about the physical world which would have the character of what we would say would be, eternal mathematical and logical law. This was David Hume, who left philosophy in a type of a quandary. The savior for thought came in the end of the 18th century. By the way, Derech Agav, that was the time of the Goyim. The Goyim lives towards the end of the 18th century. Came in the form of a German philosopher whose name was Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant initiated what I would say would be probably the most profound revolution in philosophy. Kant answered Hume by saying, in hachinami, you're right. Many times, like in Gemara, the Gemara is left with a kasha. And it's a telitz. Now, the telitz can say, no, you don't have a kasha in the first place. Or the telitz can say, no, in hachinami, you're right. You have a kasha. But what we're going to do is we're going to live with the kasha. We're going to build upon the kasha. In philosophy, that happens too. Many times, philosophers come to a tremendous kasha, and the Talmud says, right, we're going to live with the kasha, we're going to build upon the kasha. There's also physics too. Many times, physicists make experiments, we don't understand. But instead of saying you made the wrong experiment, or you had a misunderstanding of things, we build upon it and say, right, the result of experiments are correct, and reality is not as simple as we thought it was, and we're going to build upon that complexity. Now, Kant said, Hume, you're right. In hachinami, you're right, Hume. Not only are we to be skeptical about saying anything about the physical world, in fact, we can't say anything about the physical world. In fact, we never ever said anything about the physical world. All of the laws which we attribute to the physical world are really constructions of the human mind. If we attribute scientific laws of the physical world, it's only because the structure of our intellect is such is that it absorbs and assimilates data, it constructs theories, it synthesizes theories that would lead a person to suspect that these scientific theories are in fact implicit in the physical world. But the fact is, the physical world remains totally unintelligible. There's no way that man can ever make any statement about the world around him. All man could do is take data which he gets from the physical world and construct a priori models which have more to do with the logical manner in which his mind works than anything which is out there in the external world. And by these a priori models, man constructs a model, constructs theories, and imposes it upon the physical world. But the fact is, we're not making any statement about the physical world. The world in and of itself is completely opaque, unintelligible. That was the Kantian revolution in philosophy. As a result of that, what is the task of philosophy? The task of philosophy is not to go fishing and explore the ontological structure of the external world around man, because that's impossible. That's a bracha levatola. The task of philosophy is to discover the way the mind thinks. That's called the transcendental ego, to understand the way the mind thinks, and by doing that, understand the way the mind thinks, the way the mind constructs theories, and therefore philosophy once again retains its empirical role within physical science. So therefore, in other words, Kant basically made a revolution in philosophy which amounted to a destruction of man's knowledge of any aspect of the physical world. Kant himself, in his introduction to the second edition of the Critique of Pure Reason, says he has made what's called a Copernican revolution, but it's actually an involuted Copernican evolution. Copernicus made an evolution that instead of man being at the center of the universe, the man is not at the center of the universe. Kant inverted the Copernican revolution, and now once again, man is at the center of the universe. In fact, all there is man. There's no universe. The world might appear to us, but in fact, man synthesizes in accordance with the logical structure of his thinking and his conceptualization, and that's all that man can relate to in the physical world. Now, this abstraction, this a priori understanding of the workings of the human mind as being the essence of conceptualization, in fact, has played actually a central role in the halacha and the philosophy of the halacha. Because Rabban Shel Yisrael, Rabbi Yosef ben Soloveitchik, in an important hesped, a eulogy, which he delivered for his uncle, the Brisker Rav, Yitzchak Zeb Soloveitchik, once again, let's go back to our basic chronology here. The Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of the Beis Halevi, the first Yosef ben Halevi Soloveitchik, right? Two illustrious sons were Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik, usually referred to as the Brisker Rav, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who the Rav Chaslavich and afterwards became the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva University, of Yitzchak Elchanan, Ben Yitzchak Elchanan. After his Petira, Rav Yoshaber Soloveitchik, Rabbi Dr. Soloveitchik assumes the mantle of Rosh Hashiva of University. He delivered a very famous hesped on his uncle, the Brisker Rav, the Griz, Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik. And in that hesped, it appears in his collected writings, I think the title of the hesped is called Ma'adoydech Midoy, there Rabbi Yoshaber Soloveitchik says that the Kantian revolution of stressing the purity of the intellect, right, had its analogy, in fact, took place in Torah with the Shita of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik did for Torah what Lahavdil Kant did for philosophy. In philosophy, Kant postulated the a prioriness of man's intellect as separate from the world. Man creates concepts, constructs, synthesizes models of conceptualization which he imposes upon the world. Says of Yoshaber, this was the derech of his grandfather, Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, that in fact the Torah is not an empirical system of laws which looks to the world as a source for its legal structure, but rather the Torah represents an a priori intellectual system of models, of legal models, which is constructed, right? Which is min hashamayim. Man takes a role in constructing these models, and he imposes this upon the physical world. The relationship of the Torah to the world, locked to the world, the relationship of mathematics to physics. So Rabbi Yosef ben Soloveitchik, right, understood that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had basically achieved in the halacha the Kantian revolution, which Kant in fact achieved in philosophy. Now, Derech Agav, Rabbi Yishai Ben Sona Beitchek, of course, is a little bit biased towards his, the Zayde of Chayim, but in fact, the beginning, the fundamental basis for Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's philosophy of the Halacha was laid by none other than the Elta Zayde, Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Once again, the Soloveitchiks come from Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, his name was actually Chaim Yitzchaki. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, who is usually reputed to be the Talmud book of the Goyim and the founder of the Volozhiner Yeshiva, and his concept of Teira Lishma, of Teira Lishem Teira, as Teira is in fact is the a priori object with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates the world. The priorness, the ontological priorness of Teira was in fact actually the Chiddush, the new conception of Chaim Volozhiner. Chaim Volozhiner in fact ushered in a new conception of Teira related to the world. Now, why am I going into this tangent? I didn't intend to go into Brisk or Rabbi Shaber or Rav Chaim Volozhiner or Volozhiner, even though this is good to know. But the reason I'm going into this is because the first few kolam of the Goyim stress in a certain sense Chachma bin of Adat, this intellectual apprehension. In other words, the Goyim is speaking about the Chachma Satera, which man has to recover through the Rishimai. It's very interesting is the way in which man uses the Rishimai and somehow recovers the initial Chochmas HaTorah is very, very similar to the Neo-Kantian philosophy of Hermann Cohen, to which Rabbi Yishai Ben Soloveitchik devoted his doctoral thesis when he was a doctoral student in philosophy at the University of Berlin, that somehow man constructs and continually constructs a halacha. Of course, according to Hermann Cohen, it's not clear that this construction actually achieves any type of an end, but according to the Goyim, there is a teleological end in sight for the halachic process as well as for science. However, the fact is that what are we left with? We're left with intellectual constructions. It's very, very nice to speak about the Rishimai, which represents the intellectual structure apprehended by man in God's creation and in the Torah, but this only accounts for the Kantian aspect of the Torah, or of the creation. The fact is, there's a physical creation. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a physical world. Now that he created a physical world, he created specific objects. There's not only a human being, the concept of human being, there are several human beings. There's me, there's you, there's Rabbi Sedley, every person is different. Every dog is different. Every human being is different. Every duck is different. Every leaf is different. In other words, a comprehensive understanding of the creation of the world is not sufficient by man's a priori intellectual construction, which helps him to elucidate the logical structure of either Torah or of, in fact, the creation of the world. The fact is that where is there a play? What is the role of the actual physicality of the world, of the existence of the world, of the existence of things in and of themselves? Where does this come into about? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create one more than one person? Why did he create one more than one duck? Why did he create one more than one planet? In other words, the pluralism of the world must have certain significance. It's not, you know, the Goyim themselves said that Kol Bina V'Das, Bina means God created the world in a certain way. Creating the world in a certain way doesn't necessarily only refer to the fact that physical law is in a certain way, that Planck's constant is a certain, or that the Planck length is constant, or the speed of light is constant, but the actual way in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world must certainly be necessary, and part of this necessity is that we have to account for the things in and of themselves. And this, in fact, actually, was a crisis for philosophy which took place after Kant. Now, the person who sought to answer Kant. In other words, we feel that according to Kant, I mean, there's no place for the world. The world is unintelligible. What role does the world have? Now, we can't say that man's understanding of the world is purely subjective. There must be some significance in the object. Certainly, if you're a religious person who believes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu not only created objects, created subjects, but also created objects too. Although you should know something, someone handed to me today an article in the New York Times that, in fact, cosmologists have come up with a theory that basically says that it might be that all this is all in our minds, could possibly that we're not existing whatsoever, could possibly be that this whole shiur is all in your mind or in my mind or my settler's mind, and therefore my statement is actually probably not true. But that's an incredible cosmological theory, which I referred to the New York Times article about it. It was last week. It's incredible how cosmologists can actually come to some type of conclusion, which is, even if it's true, it blows the mind, literally as well as figuratively. But in any case, where is the physicality of the world, the still physicality of the world? Why did God create a physical world? Why did he create individuals? Why is there me? Why is there you? In other words, unless we have answers to this, we cannot truly claim that we have in any way deciphered, understood the ontological essence of what God's creation, what the world is. Now, the person who in fact sought to resolve this issue was a philosopher in the 19th century called Hegel. And what Hegel said, that Kant is wrong. There is a significance to the physical world. However, says Hegel, right? In other words, a physical object is not merely the sum of its properties, which is somehow synthesized by man's intellectual activity, but the object has a totality in and of itself, right? And basically, when man approaches the world, he approaches it in a dialectic. A dialectic means between the general and the particular, between the abstract and between the physical. If it's a dialectic and understanding the world's created by God, it's a dialectic between the finite and the infinite. In other words, according to Hegel, man's intellectual activity in the world is a dialectic between the infinite and the finite, between the physical and the spiritual, between the particular and the general. So in other words, what Hegel did was create a much more comprehensive understanding, not only of the ways in which different parts of the world work together, but he accounted for the fact that each object is a whole unto itself. That's what's called the idea. Then there's logic, and then there's spirit or intellect and mind by which man, in fact, engages the dialectic. And the significance of that is not only that subject, both subject and object are significant in Hegel, and they're mediated, in a certain sense, by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, but in addition to that, this dialectic is something which changes in history. The nature of dialectic is that there's movement in history. So in other words, the dialectic by its very, very nature is something which is a process, which is a method. Now, what is the fact, what is the significance of speaking about physicality? What's the significance of speaking about an individual? What does it make a difference if a person's individual? Let's just speak about humanity. Let's speak about abstract concepts, whether it be in physics or sociology, statistics. What does the individual matter in the world? So I want to claim the following thing. An individual matters if we're speaking about ethics. In other words, so long as the world is merely an abstract model which to be accounted for intellectually, that's ontology. But if we speak about ethics, if we speak about covet, honor for an individual, appreciation for pain, appreciation for suffering, appreciation, no one appreciates suffering, but appreciation for the pain that comes from suffering, then a necessary component of ethics is the particularness and the physicality of the world. The very, very famous German philosopher, which I've referred to, Hermann Cohen, said that he was led to explore his Judaism because the neo-Kantian philosophy was only an understanding of the world in general, but did not account for the individuality of every human being. The fact that every human being is different means that an abstract a priori conceptual system is not enough to account for the basic features of the world, the ethics of the world. Ethics, in other words, physics comes from law and generality. Ethics comes from particularity and from physicality. Ethics is rooted in the klal versus the prat. Ethics is worded in the spiritual versus the physical. The fight, the dialectic between physical and spiritual, the dialectic between the klal and the prat, that's play. That dialectic takes place within the stadium, within the domain of ethics. That's not for ontology, is intellectual conceptualization. Ethics is particularism and is physicality. So, in fact, right, what we have in the Goyim is that beginning with Klal Vav and Zayin, where the Goyim now introduces the extra dimensions of Chitzoini and Pnimi, of Klolus and Pratius, the Goyim, in fact, is launching into the domain of ethics. Now, of course, we spoke about ethics before in terms of the term, in terms of the physical world, but there the ethics was the Kantian ethics, the abstract intellectual a priori halakhic system, which man abstracts impose on the world. But the Goyim is not only a brisker. The Goyim is also a Bal Musa. The Goyim is a person who believes that the essence of man's ethical activity is not only confined to the abstract halacha which man imposes upon the physical world, but is related to man's physical, ethical activity in the world, which is a concern for the realism of the significance of the particularism of individuals and particularism of the world too. That's the incredible ethical dimension which the Goyim takes beginning from Klal Vav Zayin and onwards. So therefore, Gabbaisai, what we have is, we have the true ethical term. We began with the conceptual, scientific, and the Kantian Torah, Lev Chaim, and then introducing the Vav Ketzavos, Chesed, Gevurah, Tefillah, Tzedakah, Yesod, and then Malchus, we now enter into the physical part of the world. The physical part of the world demands an understanding of physicality, qua physicality, and particularness, qua particularness, as opposed to the general. And by doing something, we now have a total conceptualization and the workings of a process which brings the world to its perfection, to a theological end. Now, that's the second ha'ovah. What's the first ha'ovah? Our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu is different. So long as the the way in which we relate to Kodesh Baruch Hu is through Sfiras, that a Sfira is in fact Chochma Bina Vadas, this is intellectually apprehended. The Goyim's discussion of Chochma Bina Vadas is intellectual, which means, right, ontology, as particular specific laws, as we explain Chochma Bina Vadas. When we speak about Paltzufen, Atik Yomin, Gulgolta, Meiches Timar, Avira, Dikna, Ava, Ima, Yisrael Sabo Tavuna, Zer Antin. Then the Pautzuf takes the Sphira, which is mathematical and conceptual, and gives it a human face. The Pautzuf is a is holism. The thing unto itself, it's a whole, it's not a construction of specific qualities constructed by the subject, but the object has a wholeness unto itself. That's Paltzufkeit. That's a concept in Paltzuf, that, and not only is the wholeness unto itself, that's the human face of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. There, we relate to Kodesh Baruch Hu from a personal level. It's not Deus Mundus, but Deus Persona. Right? The Hamisher, the Tate. Where is the Tate? The Tate is in the Patsufen. Man's intellectualization of abstract spiritual concepts in the spheres. That's the Priari. What the Ari did was he discovered, this is actually the Church of the Zayah, but he explicated the personal God to which man relates to. Man's relationship to the world around him is not scientific and intellectual, it's ethical. The personal God is a whole to itself. Therefore, the world takes upon significance. Things are not just a collection of specific properties which are not particular to any substance, which things have in common with everything else, but now objects in the world becomes whole things unto itself. This is a consequence of the Hashkafa Parzufim, which the Ari is Megalat HaKlal Yisrael at the end of the 16th century. This is also the relationship, the personal relationship between man and God, because once God takes upon a personal dimension, the person represents the ultimate thing unto itself, the essence, the zenith of particularism is the individual who's an entity, who's a universe unto itself. And the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, that's when man was created one, because every person is an entire world. So therefore, what has the Ari done? What the Ari has done is that he's taken an incredible turn. Ontology has now changed. We're going from the a priori intellectual abstract to the physical particular world. Objects are not merely described abstractly by equations and by laws, but rather are wholes, are entire things unto themselves. Our relationship now can approach something which is a relationship of a man to another person, panem al panem, the personal God, not the God who creates an intellectually discernible universe, but a God to which we have an ethical relationship. This stresses the particularism, individuality of the individual. This has, in fact, its corollary in the Patsufim of the Ari, which is the way we relate to Kodesh Baruch Hu on a personal level. So the fact is that what the Goyim has done is made an incredible subtle turn. That up till now, Rekat, through the process of his Pashtus and his Talkus, there's a Hegelian type of a dialectic where man now can engage the world as a thing unto itself, as a wholeness to itself. When man confronts the world as a whole to itself, and particularly confronts other individuals unto itself, then man can establish a personal relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu through the Giloy, the revelation of the Patsufim. And that's really what the Goyim begins on Klal Vav 188, which I began the shiur almost an hour ago, and I haven't even really begun it. I haven't started reading the words. But in fact, the parts of Atik, which was just a process of symptom of scientific disengagement, now becomes a parts of Atik Yoimin. Atik Yoimin means the old of days. Chaim Harkavy has a good question. What about Kesa Malchus and the sixth, the Vav Ketzavim? That's true. The Vav Ketzavim, like this. Let's run quickly through the Patsufim. Kesa becomes actually Atik or Arich. As the Kesa will become the Sholosh Reishin, which is Gulgolta, Avira, and Merchas Diva. Chachma becomes Abba. Bina becomes Ima. The Vav Patsuf becomes Zer Anpin. Zer Anpin is actually the relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu through Mishpat, through Tzchar V'Oimish. And finally, Malchus will be Nukva. Of course, the Malchus of Nukva of the higher world becomes the Atik and Arich of the lower world. We'll speak about that in Mitzvah Hashem. But the fact is, that's the basically layout of the Sefiras as opposed to the Patsufim. And that's what we have to know. We meet Hashem will go in detail in the following Shi'olim. So therefore, students, listeners, the Goyim has spanned all of Western philosophy. From Descartes, Hume, Kant, Hegel. We're not finished. But the Goyim is basically taking all of Western philosophy, which is a historical development of thought, and place it within an entire system of Kabbalah. The essence is to flush out the development of man's mind, of man's consciousness, in the teleological fashion to which history brings us closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to a vision of the world which will illuminate the wisdom and the essence of what God is in his relationship to man. And so by doing this, Chaim Hakavi is, what is the role of the Siska Tzavim as pure spheres? The answer is, we'll see in the Goyin that becomes their Anpeh. The role of Siska Tzavim will be that their Anpeh, in a certain sense, is incomplete, because as a result, the Tikkunin takes place, men rectifies the universe by embedding what's called Moichin, the Chachma Bina Vadas, into their Anpeh. As their Anpeh somehow was completed into 10 spheres, and by doing that, this achieves the spiritual perfection of their Anpeh. The Goyin has spoken about Siska Tzavos, but we'll see in Mitzvah Shem that later on he will refer to Zer Anpin and Nukva, and in fact rehash or reinterpret everything he said in terms of Partzufa. We'll get to that at later on in these Shi'or. Okay. So anyway, so I bid everyone farewell. We should really appreciate the gift that the Goyin has given to the world. I want to thank Mrs. Klavan. I didn't mention Mrs. Klavan up till now, but she's done a wonderful job in engineering this shiur, and I want to thank her for all her efforts, the chalal for Nala, and we wish you a lot of hatzlacha. She claimed for coming from Beit Shemesh, and until next week, a kotavach, a lot of hatzlacha this week, and we have a lot to think about. Be well.